Welcome to the Intertidal Talks podcast. I am Kendra, marine biologist and your host. This podcast is meant to teach, inform, and entertain you about all things marine science and conservation. If you are a marine scientist or advocate with a story to share, you can contact me at intertidaltalks@gmail.com. Want to join our marine science community? Join us at patreon.com/kendi_marinebio. Hello, 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 everybody. It is Kendra here with Intertidal Talks, and today we are going to be talking about the film Blackfish. Now, it is just going to be me again for this episode, and I am making this because today I filmed a YouTube episode with my friend Taylor, who has been on this podcast, where we reviewed Blackfish. We have this new series on her YouTube channel called Marine Biology Movie Club. So go check that out. It'll be coming out same time as this. That video is more kind of us having a conversation with our past, with SeaWorld, a lot of our thoughts about Blackfish as well. And this podcast is just going to be more of kind of like the facts, the claims, debunking a lot of stuff in Blackfish. So at some points, it may come off very pro-captivity. At other points, I'm going to come off very anti-captivity. So to clarify my stance on captivity, I am against it. I think it is inherently immoral. I don't think that with cetaceans, I don't think all captivity is immoral. Correction. But with cetaceans particularly, because highly migratory, highly intelligent, and the things that we've seen happen, I do not agree with it. However, I do know that there are nuances. It is far more complex than people kind of give it credit for, I guess I could say. And I don't think it is as simple as a yes or no, support, don't support, essentially. So I personally think it's wrong, but there are nuances to it. There are things in this film, for example, that are wrong and that they take out of context that I have big issues with. I don't think this film is like a perfect example of approaching this argument. I think it has a lot of issues. It has good things, but it has bad things. And I really don't love seeing it reigned as like the most amazing film that everyone should watch. I mean, I think it's important. It gets a lot out there. It does really well getting people emotional about the issue, but I just really wish that more education was there, that they had brought up different points than the points they did bring up. So we're going to dig into that, basically. It's kind of hard. I don't know like where to start with this. I guess one of the first things to debunk is the film starts off with the 911 calls about the attack on Dawn by Tillicum in 2010. And I kind of understand like why this happens, but basically the person on the phone is like, he swallowed the arm, or maybe that was in a different part. Basically they're like implying the arm is gone. The arm is swallowed. The arm was ripped off. And they don't ever correct this in the film. And people, I've seen it on the internet, where people are like, he literally ate her arm, like in comment sections. So I am here to debunk that. So what actually happened was, if you read the coroner's report, which is completely public access, you can literally Google it and it pops up. According to Dawn's coroner report, she died from drowning, but also trauma. So physical trauma. And what happened with her arm was that her left upper arm was completely avulsed. Now, avulsed is not like completely ripped off the body. Now, I looked at pictures and I regret it because I hate gore. So don't look at pictures, but you can Google the definition. The definition is basically that like tendons, muscle, basically just things are stripped off the bone. So it kind of leaves like a bare looking bone. It's really gross looking. Oh my goodness, I can't get the images out of my head, but it's not ripped off. Now I can see where it may have appeared to have been ripped off, where they then now claim that it had been ripped off. I understand why that was said, especially in the moment when you're calling 911. It's hard. But yeah, her arm was not literally ripped off, at least according to the coroner's report, which is, again, public access. You can read it. So saying he swallowed it, that is incorrect. And I really think And they didn't correct that in the film. I really wish that after they had played the audio clip, that they had said, like, kind of shown what the coroner's report said. They do at some point, but they don't, like, I guess, correct that information, which bugs me. On top of that, she had a severed spinal cord, and then they talk about how she was scalped, and that's kind of as much as they go into it, that she was scalped. I don't know. That is just something that, for me, always, I'm like, really? Like, she didn't swallow the arm? I get as a film why you picked this weird, like, to put that in, but it is something that, like, they should have corrected. So I guess that's the first thing I'm going to clear up. No, he didn't swallow her arm. Now, I'm going to also just immediately go into talking about Tillicum and kind of his timeline. So he was caught in 1983 in Iceland. He was 2 years old, about 11 and a half feet long, and he was brought to Sealand of the Pacific in Victoria. Here is another part of the film I have a big issue with and that I don't like, and people should know about. So in February of 1991, that is when the Keltyburn incident occurred, and Keltyburn was killed, and there is a big whodunit. Now, in the movie, they talk to two women who were at the park that day, and these women were not a part of the official report on this incident. They were not official witnesses. And I kind of am wondering now that if the filmmakers or whoever was interviewing them was kind of probing for this, but one of them says the one with the flopped fin, attacked her. And so the film definitely sets that up to make you think that it was Tillicum, because Tillicum has a flopped fin. We all know that males have flopped fins. But here's the thing. Haida and Nootka, who are also the two females at Sealand of the Pacific, both had flopped fins as well. Now, if you watch the video with Taylor, we will be showing pictures of Haida and Nootka, but they also had droopy, you know, leaning fins. Now, theirs lean to the right, and Tillicum's lean to the left, I believe. But they don't tell you that, and so it really sets it up that Tillicum was the instigator, the one who was just vicious and attacked her, and that these two females, like, weren't involved. But really, the coroner's report inquest found all three responsible and just put it on that all three were involved to some degree. And that makes way more sense than, like, just putting it all on Tillicum. And there's a lot of reasons why it makes more sense. One is that they talk about how those two females often displaced him and would rake him. He was not a dominant individual. So leading an attack in a show or a demonstration where all three of them were involved, him starting that, it's interesting to kind of think about, because he would not be the one to kind of go for that. I have no doubt probably that he was involved in some degree, but knowing that all their fins were flopped, knowing the hierarchy, knowing those two females' relationship with him, and his personality, that him maybe starting it at least doesn't make sense. And the film pinning it on him, essentially, with the flopped fin remark and not showing the other two animals, that is, I think it's ridiculous. I think, of course, they're setting up the narrative that they want, which is Tillicum's storyline of how he became the psychotic killer, which, again, not true, or not, it doesn't make any, I don't like that. But Tillicum was also described by most trainers as a well-behaved, trusted, happy whale. He was super gentle with calves. That was something he was kind of known for. He had great relationships with some of the other animals. Like Taima was one of them. It's in his profile that he has a close relationship with Taima. And the film kind of touches on that, but you really, like, I feel like you watch it and you're scared of him because of all this, because from literally the beginning when he was at Sealand, and he was caught in 1983, he was 2 years old at the time, so he's like, let's see, how old is he by 1991? Like, he's about, like, 10. I'm not good at math, so whatever. But basically, he is still young, but it's really setting you up that just from the beginning, essentially, is what this feels like. And I just think it's, I don't know if you can, like, defame an animal, but it's like Tillicum defamation. So past that, you know, he gets moved to Orlando. One of those females is moved with him. I am I'm pretty sure it was Haida that was moved with him to SeaWorld Orlando. And he was isolated a lot from the beginning. Not all the time, of course. He was with females, but on his profile, one of the things he finds adversive is prolonged social access to other whales. So something about Tilikum, which I would credit it to the fact that he doesn't, you know, he was stuck with Haida and Nootka, and they were very aggressive with him with their raking, that he just didn't love being with probably a lot of the dominant females. He liked being with some whales. Like I said, Taima, he was with calves. I think him and Trua would be partnered up a lot or paired up, you know. I've never been to Orlando, so like I can't say that I've seen him with anyone in particular. But just from what I've heard was that he would be paired up with a lot. I think it sounds like more younger and less dominant animals. But dominant females, no. Which makes sense. And that's in his profile. So his isolation, I think, not in the film, I think maybe they did bring up his isolation a little bit, that he was alone and that they'd bring him out for the big splash. But part of that was because of his profile. It wasn't like he was this antisocial, like, sociopath animal. That wasn't it. And I kind of think that it almost comes off that way, that he's just this big, scary animal. But no, that was something he just didn't like, was that amount of social interaction. So then, you know, the film goes everywhere, but I'm just going to talk about Tilikum right now. So in July 1999, that's the Daniel Duke incident. This is one that they bring up, but I feel like they don't cover well enough. And this is why. So Daniel Duke was the guy that broke into SeaWorld and was like, you know, got in the tank, and they came in the morning and there's this dead guy. And the documentary's like, he killed someone. Yeah, a random guy jumps into a tank. What do you, like, not trained, like, if you jumped in, he's probably, like, bugging the animal at night. Like, if someone did that in a tiger enclosure and the tiger lashed out, you know, we'd be like, yeah, that guy's an idiot. But for some reason, I feel like the documentary really sets it up as, like, Tilikum just is bloodthirsty and he ripped his balls off and, you know, because that's, he did. But, like, yeah, who wouldn't do that to a stranger in your home? But on top of that, they kind of touch about how they not know till the morning. And at first I'm like, okay, well, like, maybe the night watch trainer just was, like, not paying attention. The guy could have, like, it didn't necessarily have to be noisy. If the guy jumped in and then immediately was dragged down, there wouldn't necessarily be a lot of noise that would maybe alert a night watch trainer, you could claim. And so if he got in and then was immediately, like, dragged down, it's going to be a pretty noiseless incident. But at the time, there was a two-week-old calf at SeaWorld Orlando, which would indicate that there should have been about 4 night watch trainers. There is a chance that maybe they were lying and they did notice and they just didn't alert anything till the morning, especially with the fact that there were supposed to be 4 on night watch because of the 2-week-old calf, which was Tuar or Tuar. I can't pronounce things. But again, that's another thing. I'm just like, you know, what could have been done if they had spotted him at night? All that kind of stuff. Like, maybe he had broken in more towards the morning, kind of. I don't know. Again, that there was more detail to that incident that they don't explain that they could have. And I definitely think they could have set that up to be really, really bad by saying there was a calf and there should have been 4 night watch trainers. And we really believe they didn't notice. But, you know, as I just said, there are also issues with that claim, because it's very possible that Tilikum could have killed this man by drowning him, and there wouldn't have been any noise. So how would they have known? Now we move to Dawn's incident. And before talking about Dawn, there was the issue that they did not really get permission to talk about Dawn's story from her family. Now Dawn loved her job, loved the animals. I don't think she ever would have agreed to be a part of this had she been alive. This was her whole life. And I do think that's disrespectful to do. And they really flushed it all out. And it irks me now just because of how so many anti-captivity people take it and are so vindictive and like evil about trainers. It's inappropriate. It is ridiculous. Trainers are not bad people. Dawn was not at fault. And they set that up. They do set that up that it wasn't her fault. And I think they do, you know, a decent job. But it leaves so much room for trainers to get criticism in this film when I really think that all of the pressure should be on management completely. And that is an issue that I have with it. Now, going on to the February incident, I already talked about her coroner's report, didn't need her arm, but they had been having issues all day with the animals. And this incident occurred during a dine-in, and they attribute it to a missed bridge on the perimeter peck wave, which they show. And that just slowly deteriorated, and he got more frustrated, and he was running low on the food, and it was just ice, and you could hear that. The food claim I find a little iffy because the animals do get fed everything by the end of the day. They don't go hungry, and Tilikum would be aware of that. So I don't really necessarily think it was the food, but on his profile again, one of the things that Tilikum finds aversive was repetition during learning with repetitive incorrect responses. And he had done a correct behavior, not received his positive feedback, the fish as a reward, essentially, and that frustrated him, and that was something that he did find aversive. Again, like, I don't think anyone's at fault for that. Like, Don blew the bridge, he didn't hear it, and he continued to do it. He did not the full behavior she wanted, but, you know. So I don't think it was necessarily the food that was a huge driving factor, but more that he just was, they knew him to not like repetition during learning with repetitive incorrect responses. He just had this kind of just natural, I would say, irritation towards this. And that probably led into it. It probably was issues all day. You know, we all have bad days. And, you know, we know what happens. Drags are in and whatnot. Now, there is the back and forth people have with whether or not SeaWorld truly blamed her or not. Now, there is footage of them implying it was something she faulted. Whether you agree with that or not, there is footage that shows that. Her family still supports SeaWorld, and so I don't think that they were deeply offended by that. Of course, I think if she was here that she would disagree, because she, I think, was doing everything correctly. I think just it's an animal. Animals are unpredictable. I've worked with animals. You can know an animal as much as you think, and then they can just be having a bad day. And I don't think it was anyone's fault. SeaWorld blaming it, that's a very PR move. And just from a business standpoint, it makes sense for them to go that route. I don't think it's something the whole institution is responsible for, meaning other trainers, whatnot. I'm sure trainers disagree with that video, but it was basically the PR people and whatnot that were kind of put on the front line. But there is footage of it. I kind of can't argue with that. I think it was wrong of them, but it's a business, and businesses everywhere do things that are wrong. So that's like all of Tilikum's background. Obviously, I think the biggest one for me is that issue with Kelty and the arm. The arm thing, it's so annoying. And then the Kelty issue of all of them having flopped fins and them picking the witnesses that weren't even used in the official like investigation is interesting, especially knowing even from like a general law standpoint, a lot of times eyewitness accounts aren't super reliable, because the way you ask a question can create like a false memory or a false idea. So that is like that's one thing I think of and I look at, and I'm just like, it's an interesting way that they went about that, because it's so easily something that is discredited and proven. Like, we have pictures of Haida and Nootka with their flopped fins. But again, I think the narrative was all about Tilikum, and to kind of create this weird storyline about this animal who, like, they tried to set up as like friendly and innocent, but at the same time, almost like he was like a sociopath, but as a whale, which I just don't like, because I don't think it's accurate. I don't think that's what it is. He's a complex animal with complex emotions, with complex cognitive abilities. And just like a human, you have bad days. You could be aggressive. He had this, I think he was traumatized by capture, by how he was, the interactions he had with the other females, all that raking and displacement. I think that created more of just how he reacts to certain situations. I know a lot of people have the issue of anthropomorphizing. I know Ken Balcom in the film says something along the lines of he was in a psychosis. I wouldn't necessarily call it psychosis.
But yes, I do find that we have to be really cautious how we anthropomorphize animals. And we do it on both sides. And that's one thing, is that pros will criticize antis for anthropomorphizing the pain and depression. But pros anthropomorphize, I feel like, a lot of, oh, they're just so friendly and so happy. We all do it. But I think we can all acknowledge that what happened to Tilikum probably did impact how he reacted to situations. And there was probably a bit of trauma, and that happens. That happens with our dogs. When a dog is beat up, there is a trauma, there's a response. And you don't blame the dog for being abused and responding in a way. I think the same should be kind of said about Tilikum. I don't think he was a sociopath, as they kind of set up. I think he had been raised in a way, he had at once endured training with negative reinforcement, and that he just... That affects personality in humans, in dogs, and I think in whales. And that is, we see that in his aversive effects on his profile. Prolonged social access to other whales. He kind of knew. He liked, I think, to be more so with himself or with the animals that they kind of knew he had a good relationship with. Now, moving on from Tilikum, there are a few other things that the movie claims. One is, I think Howard says, there's no case of a wild orca harming a human. That is untrue. And I think part of it is that a lot of people don't know about this. People claim this everywhere. But there is at least one documented bite incident with a surfer in, I forget where. But there are also some other incidents that I think we don't credit, because they're not in the water. Now, orcas have been documented to be aggressive with boats. Documented, but also undocumented just by, like, people talking. But in Spain recently, that was one of the big ones. There was, like, all over where these whales, the killer whales in that area, would kind of, like, swim at boats. They are documented bumping boats that just kind of bug them, essentially, in the Salish Sea. This happens as well. I think those count as a killer whale kind of showing aggression. Dolphins will do it as well. My professor in university had told me about when he was working on a fishing vessel that bottlenose dolphins would come up and like smack the boat, and they would steal their fish and just were obviously causing a problem and knew that they could go for the boat, tip fish off the boat, or do something to the nets to get the fish out. So these animals are highly intelligent. They kind of know what boats are doing. They know, you know, kind of what's going on. And that happened in Spain with the orcas disrupting the fishing boats. I think those should count as maybe adverse interactions with humans that killer whales have. They're not attacks, you know, as we would claim, like a shark attack when a shark bites. There's only like the one with killer whale. There might be others, you know, but that is technically a false claim in the movie by saying there are none. There is. There are. Now, next, there is the how old do they live. It shows footage of the different people in the park saying they live longer there. I actually have a video from 2018 of a trainer telling me that they live longer in captivity than they do in the wild. We know that not to be true. Now, population ages vary per population. There isn't really a one-all, like a end-all, be-all age length for killer whales as an entire like species. Each population will have different ones. Now, in captivity, 90% of females have died before the age of 25. There was an interesting study done in 2015 by Robeck et al., and it found that in captivity, about 45% of whales have made it to sexual maturity, which is about 14 to 15 years old, and 7% have reached menopause age, and that's 35 to 40 years old. So, you know, that's, oh, okay, 45% reach sexual maturity. But in comparison, southern resident killer whales, an endangered population, 80% reach sexual maturity. Again, that's about 14 to 15 years old. Whereas 45% will hit menopause. Again, 35 to 40 years old. So in comparison to that one population, and they purposely did it to an endangered population because even when compared to a population in the wild that is, it's critically endangered, and we see high mortality rates, they are still not racking up to half of those percentages. It's 45% of sexual maturity in captivity versus 80% in southern residents. And the average age for captive orcas is about 15 years old. That is not counting stillbirths and calves that died before 1 year old. That's not very high. And we are very lucky that there are several individuals that live past that, that we have the, you know, Orchid is the oldest captive-born orca. She's about 32 right now. We have Corky, who is like 55. Like, we have whales that have lived longer, obviously. But the average, when you factor in every orca, the average is about 15. It's about your teens. It may be closer to 20s. My 15 number may be off now, but that is kind of the credited number, about 15, about teens, you know. With that, there are currently like 60 orcas in captivity, but 170 have died since captivity kind of first became a thing in 1961. That is not including 31 unsuccessful pregnancies and not including 15 that have been known to have died during capture. Now, that number is probably higher, but we have 15 recorded. So if we added all those numbers together, it is 215 killer whales that have died because of captivity to some degree, or have died within captivity. And also, that number does not count Ishmael and Keiko, because they didn't technically die within captivity. So those two are excluded. So that is 60 currently living orcas to 215. And those odds, they're really bad. And I know a lot of that is obviously earlier on. Care was not as good as it is now. But we still see death now. And we still see unexpected. We still see issues. We just this week saw Skyla just suddenly die. We saw Takara with her new calf years back die. We saw Kayla die a few years ago. Though the numbers are there, and that is one thing I've never, even when I was pro cap, I could never argue. And I think as people who support captivity, that you should also just be cognizant of those numbers. And yes, a lot of that is because it is a growing industry. It is an industry that is constantly learning about the animals. And there are things that are outside of our control, like when Kasaka was just ill and we could not do much to help her at that point. And now with Skyla, when we found out how she died, there's not much you can do at a certain point. Of course, I'm not saying like that there's so much more we can do. Obviously there is, but I'm just saying the numbers are there, and it's really hard to argue with those numbers, especially when 95%, when not 95, haha, 90% of female killer whales will die before the age of 25. There, of course, are the outliers, and outliers are awesome, but the average, the higher percentage, they are not meeting their lifespan potential and how long they probably should be living, essentially, is how I want to say that. There are so many ways to look at lifespan, to look at how we've analyzed lifespans in the past. I know Granny is one of those killer whales in the wild that, oh, she's over 100, but I'm pretty sure by now we've actually correctly said she was probably more about 80. But that 100 number is still floating around out there. That's the sad part of it, misinformation. Once it is out there, and we cannot do much. And no matter how much we maybe try and spread the correct information, some people will never see that. And we'll always think of that false number, which is irking from a scientific perspective. But again, like I said, nuance to this issue, layers. There's lots of things to talk about with these lifespans. But overall, captive whales have a lower lifespan than the populations that they are coming from. I think that's kind of a good way to put that. Now, another thing that they show in the film is a lot of trainers and educators at SeaWorld saying that 25% of wild orcas have dorsal collapse. I wonder if any of these are cut out of context, because that number does come from somewhere. It's not just a made-up number they pulled out of their butt. That number is sort of coming from a study done in New Zealand by Ingrid Visser in the 90s that showed about 23% of New Zealand killer whales had LSI, or a loss of structural integrity in the dorsal fin. So that number's coming from somewhere. Yeah, the New Zealand population is known to have more dorsal fin integrity issues, structural issues, because not all of it is like a complete flopped over fin. Even in captivity, there's Katina, Nakai, Shuka that don't have your generic curled flopped over fin, but more of a slant and a bend. but some sort of structural integrity issue of the dorsal fin. And they don't, I also don't like that SeaWorld doesn't, not SeaWorld, Blackfish doesn't explain why this occurs. I think that that is really important knowledge because people take that as, I see it all the time of, they're depressed, their fins flopped. They're nim nim lin, that's why their fins flopped. They don't feed them, that's why their fins flopped. And none of that is true. The fin is flopped, likely. This is like the leading hypothesis right now, but because they spend a lot of time at their at the surface versus in the wild, where obviously we're swimming a lot more in the water, that builds a lot of strength and muscle in that fin. Whereas if you're sitting at the surface, if you're not doing high energy underwater behaviors all the time, that will cause your fin to not have that same structural strength as maybe a wild counterpart. And it doesn't inhibit on their health. It does not make the animal unhealthy. It is, I think it, for a captive whale, it's more of a visual thing that we just see as an issue. And a lot of people take that as a visual indicator of, oh, they're depressed. And that is not true. Now in the wild, generally when a fin has some sort of structural integrity issue, it is associated either with emaciation or an anthropogenic cause, which is human caused. So like there's Corkscrew in the New Zealand population and his fin has issues because of boat interference and stuff like that. So I think that I'm wondering if some of that footage is taken out of context. Maybe there were some trainers that had said, oh, in New Zealand, 25% or some populations, 25%, and they kind of cut out maybe that first part. I do wonder because I do not think just – and honestly, maybe a trainer had just heard that 25% of orcas have a flopped over fin and was like, oh, okay, because technically that is true for a population. I believe in the overall world population, I think it's about like 2% of killer whales have LSI, loss of structural integrity. It is not super common on all populations, but it is higher in some populations. And that, again, that's same with lifespan. It is a varying issue that we cannot broad stroke over an entire species and over the entirety of captive killer whales as well. Because there are also captive killer whales that have kind of almost beaten that. Nakai is one of those. Nakai's dorsal fin. Nakai is a killer whale in SeaWorld San Diego, but his dorsal fin was pretty much straight for a really long time, whereas other males, once they kind of hit that age where the fin starts to grow, because about 7 years old, male killer whales will do what we call sprout, which is like the hit puberty, and that's where their fin will start to grow to that massive size. And about sprouting age, other whales' fins kind of like immediately flopped over. I think Keat is one of those. He's always had just a really flopped, curly fin. But Nakai is like 19 now, I think. I may be wrong. He may be in his 20s, but he is well past, you know, that sprouting age, and his fin still has pretty strong structural integrity. I haven't seen a recent picture where it's truly flopped. It appears that some days it's more bent looking, more like how catenas look. Now, 100% of captive males in captivity have loss of structural integrity on their fins. Again, it varies to the severity. Like I said, Nakai, he's an outlier. Makani is his little brother. Maybe Makani will have a similar dorsal fin reaction. We don't know. So I find that really interesting, this whole dorsal fin issue. But I would like to let anyone know their fins do not flop when they are depressed. That is incorrect. And when you say that, you look like a fool. And when you say no wild orcas have collapsed fins, you also look like a fool. That's not true. Because some do. Some wild killer whales will have structural integrity issues with their dorsal fins. And so I really wish, yes, they had explained that. And kind of flushed that issue out a little bit more. Flushed both these out. But again, their main premise of this documentary was Tilikum. And sadly, it wasn't to flush out a lot of facts. But to kind of set up like a fact, kind of, and then move on back to Tilikum. And I think that was one of the main arguments against the film, and that's one of my main issues with it, is that it almost gets there with some issues. Like, it brings it up just enough that when someone hears it, like, oh, and then they just use that and they don't look into it more. Which I think documentaries should give you the full fact, or at least give you resources to look into more, kind of set it up for you and kind of introduce, like, this issue is nuanced, or there's lots of studies going on. And that is one of my issues with said portion of this film. Another point of the film, and there's a lot of things, like, in it that they just kind of bring up, like I kind of said, a little bit and then move on. But one of those is they talk about breeding and likening Tilikum siring calves to breeding a violent dog. And there's many reasons I disagree, and I think that this is a interesting point to keep in the film. He is not domesticated like dogs are. And genetically, I would not say his aggression stems from genetics. And that's kind of like the main point I got there. Like I said earlier, I think a lot of his issues came from interactions he had. They were circumstantial. They were not built into him. And implying that again is almost again like that weird sociopath vibe I get, that he's like this sociopathic whale that just from the beginning was awful, which is the narrative they set up that it's not there. And he is not a genetically bad animal. His calves are not genetically impaired immediately with heightened chance of aggression, because he had these three aggressive incidents where he was a part in killing someone. The Kelty Burn one, again, there were three involved and all three were implied to have been responsible. So that one I don't count as much. And then you know how I feel about the Daniel Duke one. I don't fault him for that. I would also not be happy someone jumped in my tank. But those are not things that I think you can akin to a genetic breeding issue in, like, a fighting dog, in a pit bull, in these dogs. And again, even with those animals, like, we know it's so nuanced that, again, these are animals that also, they became that way because of circumstance. I would say if we were, like, eons down with killer whales, and it was a captive born, like, sixth generation, maybe then, and they were hyper aggressive from the get-go, that is when I would see this argument making more sense. Not with a captive caught whale, and not with one with his history, with, I think, the trauma that Tilikum endured in his life. And on that, I am going to kind of expound more on this, on some interesting aggression attack statistics I learned in the process of kind of researching for this. So out of 153 recorded incidents with killer whales in captivity, only 16 involved whales who were either with their mothers at their own birth park and had never experienced a transfer. All others were done by wild-caught whales. Well, okay, all others were either done by wild-caught whales, whales that had been separated from their mother, or their mother had died, or whales that had been transferred. That statistic is wild to me. Wild. It basically shows a direct correlation between separating an animal from family park, either, and that heightens aggression. And I think that is more because of the trauma that comes from being separated from your mother, especially from an animal that is so matriarchal, with so involved with their calves that are usually with mothers for a long, long time, and that has an adverse effect. And again, as a pro, people who are listening that are pro, I think this is a really important point to take in to effect, is that there is this direct correlation between separating an animal and how many incidents have occurred. Now, again, there are those 16 that are not related to those issues of being separated from their family, from their park, or wild caught. But those are the outliers. You look at the data, the majority, we tend to just say, yes, of course there are going to be outliers. Of course there are going to be incidents. I'd be interested, I would really like to know what those 16 incidents were, because when I looked, it didn't go through every single one. But I think that's really interesting. I think that's an interesting statistic to look at for aggression and what causes it. Again, it is not some genetic issue. I believe it was always circumstantial. Now, moving on to another issue with the documentary that I have. Yes, I am explaining a lot of my issues with the documentary. This is not an episode to praise this documentary. But they talk about, they have John Hargrove talk about the separation of Kasaka and Takara. And obviously, from John's perspective, any separation of Takara from Kasaka is sad. And from any perspective, I think at the baseline, it is sad that that has to happen. But if you look at the full story, you can kind of understand why they did it. And let me explain. So Takara was about 12 years old when this occurred, when she was separated from Kasaka. And Takara had her own calf, which they leave out. And now John Hargrove has said in his book that a lot of his interview was cut out because he had just left the parks and had a lot of good feelings still. So I haven't read it in a long time, but he basically says like, yeah, I don't think they liked what I said because a lot of it was positive. And so I really think they kind of struggled to find things because he still had a lot of positive feelings, because he credits his departure towards his arthritis more so than the claim that he was kind of let go for issues he kind of caused, and his, I think, lack of following safety protocol. But again, in his book, he credits it to his arthritis and that he was very sad to leave and he wasn't fully against captivity at the time. And so I think that might be why he just was kind of talking about how sad he was, because he loved Takara and he loved Kasaka, and seeing them separated at any degree was heartbreaking for him. Bottom line, yes, I agree with that. But they supposedly were moving Takara from Kasaka, from SeaWorld San Diego, because she had been disruptive and was being aggressive towards a lot of the other animals. It was causing a lot of issues with how shows were run, and Takara is just very dominant, as is Kasaka, and so they kind of had to just move her to kind of get a rhythm back at San Diego. It is heartbreaking for Kasaka, but I think that is an important detail to leave out, that transfer wasn't just like the one they described before with Katina and Kalina. That one is sad. Kalina was 4.5, and that's so young. That is so young, and it's heartbreaking, and I think that one is unnecessary. But this one is not the same, and they present it as the same, and they don't give you, I think, the detail of Takara being 12 with her own baby to kind of make it seem, again, like it's a baby calf being separated from a mom. And that's not what it is. And they show a lot of footage that does not match up, of course. And I know a lot of people have issue with that, and I'm going to cover that in a little bit about the B-roll footage not lining with the story. But that it is misleading, and I do think that the full story makes sense. Now, what they should have done with this is use separation to maybe talk about how separating mama from baby and baby from mama impacts how that future baby becomes a mother. So after they moved to Kara, they moved to Kara and Kohana. Kohana was the calf at the time, to Orlando. Now in 2006, at about 3 years old, Kohana is transferred from Orlando to Loro Parque in Spain. Now Kohana has now had two calves of her own and has rejected both of them. We have seen a pretty strong correlation of mothers that are separated from their mothers at too young of an age have an issue raising their own calves. Now, Kohana just kind of rejected them. She had Adon and Victoria. Adon is still alive. Victoria did pass. Both were hand-raised by trainers. She just really isn't. She didn't become like that mother. She wasn't like how Kasaka was a mother, how Takara was a mother, how Katina was a mother. Very involved, great killer whale mothers. She never learned that. And it's heartbreaking that happened, and that being separated, she was a baby, and that does impact her. And it was wrong. Point blank, period. I don't think that there should be room for argument there. And we know that that adversely affected her and now her young. It adversely affects entire generations of killer whale. And I love Kasaka and Takara. And when looking into all this for the episode that I just recorded with Taylor, there were pictures of when Takara was giving birth to Kohana and how Kisaka is right next to her the entire time. And Takara was there with her own mother when her mother gave birth again. And it is very sad and raw for me, kind of, because I loved Kisaka so much to know that she was there for Kohana's birth. She was there helping Takara. And then all of a sudden, Takara and Kohana are taken away. Takara goes to Orlando. She's pregnant with Trua. And then at 3 years old, they take Kohana away from her in 2006. Then in 2009, she's moved from Orlando to Texas, and Trua stays in Orlando. So she's separated from another calf. And obviously, Trua is a male, so he's not needing to mother babies. But again, like, that's two calves that Takara is not with. And I will always wonder what would happen if she was ever reunited with them. I wonder so much. What would that look like? I wonder, you know? I don't know if any of you guys wonder that, but I wonder that. And now she lives in Texas. Takara lives in Texas with two calves that have been with her since their birth, not separated from her. They're Kisaka's next three calves. None of them were taken from her. Takara was the only calf that Kisaka was separated from. Nakai was right after Takara, stayed with her. Kalia was after Nakai. Kalia was with Kisaka. And Makani was Kisaka's last calf. And Makani is still at SeaWorld San Diego, and he was never separated from his mother until she passed. And I applaud that they didn't separate when it wasn't necessary for the rest of Kisaka's calves. But other whales weren't so lucky, like Katina. And there are other things that we've seen with calf separation. In the film, they talk about Kisaka's aggression with Ken Peters. Now, when I was talking to Taylor, she actually said that she thought that it was Tilikum that had done that. And so she feels like that was misconstrued, which I find really interesting because I just kind of know it's Kisaka from the get-go. So I think my brain's just like, ooh, like maybe I kind of fill in the words there. But it is Kisaka at San Diego with Ken Peters. It is not related to Tilikum at all. And the why that happened is kind of credited to Kisaka wanting to be with Kalia. Now, Kalia was in another pool calling from the gate during the show, supposedly. And she was under 2 years old and shouldn't have been separated from her mom. And so they think Kisaka knew she could kind of act out to get the show to stop and get reunited with her calf. And another instance is Orchid. They talk about Orchid and Splash being aggressive with Tamari. And Orchid, her mother died when she was between 7 and 11 months old. I say that because I found different conflicting reports of how old she was. And so I just want to say she was under a year old. She was under a year old when her mother died. And her mother was the one that died bleeding out in the tank that they kind of show in the film. And so, you know, my statistic earlier that I said that, you know, most aggressive incidents were by killer whales that had either been wild caught, separated, transferred, or had a dead mother. And Orchid had a dead mother. And on top of that, a very traumatizing dead mother, because her mom bled out while she was in the tank with her. And she was under a year old. And because of how cognitive these animals are, I can only wonder what that did. Orchid has had aggression issues. I think she is one of those higher, quote-unquote, aggressive animals. Again, quote-unquote, aggressive. They talk about her and Splash attacking Tamari. They show footage of her bleeding on the slide out in the beginning of the film, and where they talk about hyperaggression. And they carry on from that footage to show the footage of Kandu bleeding out to death. Kandu bled out within 45 minutes of rupturing the artery in her jaw. And she was only 14 years old, Orchid under 11 months. Now, luckily, Corky, the animal that was kind of involved in this altercation, adopted Orchid from that day. And we know Corky has done that with other animals. With other, not animals, other of the killer whales at SeaWorld San Diego, kind of like becoming like a pseudo mom for them. But yeah, Orchid is one of those like more aggression-prone animals with the issue with Tamari, and shows again that there is this interesting correlation between the separation or traumatizing incidents with a lack of mother in an increased aggressive whale. Another one I think of just off the top of my head, I don't have like data behind this, would be like Shuka, separated and she was born in France and then transferred to, I think, Ohio and then to San Diego. So she's had multiple transfers and she is one that is quote unquote more aggressive. And every time I think of Shuka, I think of in John Hargrove's book, he talks about he talks about how when he was in the Marineland, Marineland, France, that he was working on training with Shuka, and he was in the tank and she wasn't coming up to kind of like do the behavior, and he looks down and she's like underneath him with her mouth open, and it like freaked him out, but he handled the situation. She didn't you know attack him, but that he was well aware in that moment that she could, you know, take care of him. They are very capable at any moment to not do a behavior, to switch, and that's part of knowing that you're working with a killer whale. So all those points, I'm basically, let me like wrap that up. Basically, like, I think everything I just was explaining was the separation issues and how that we know that that impacts whales. And I hope all that made sense. It makes sense when I'm saying it, but I may be all over the place. So I'm just going to move on to my next topic now, which I reached out and I asked people to kind of tell me what their issues with this film were. And most people had to tell me that they did not like the B-roll footage and how it wasn't what they were actually talking about. One of those being, what was one? How when they talk about moving Tilikum from Sealand to Orlando, they're showing footage of Keiko being moved from Mexico. And like, I get the frustration. I do. However, it is minor compared to, I'd say, the vocal claims that they either misconstrue or don't fully elaborate on. I won't say they lie, because the only thing I would maybe say they lie about is the eating the arm. But again, because they don't technically say it, they just show, they just like record the footage. It's more that they just misconstrue that. They don't correct it. Actually, I will say that maybe I would dance around the word lie with the Kelty witness people. Like, I think that was irresponsible to include those two points particularly. But a lot of issues with the B-roll, and I will just say that is part of film. That is part of documentary. Now that I've like taken marine science courses and learned a lot, I look at any kind of documentary, and a lot of documentaries do this where they take random B-roll footage, random B-roll orca sounds, and play it over. And if we use that to discredit anything and everything, it'd be hard, because a lot of movies do that. And I think part of the issue is that they didn't like go, from my knowledge, didn't like infiltrate the parks to film. They used a lot of stuff on YouTube. They used a lot of stuff, I think, that was just like submitted essentially, and that they had just found online. And so they kind of got to work what you got. And another, I know one footage they kind of take out of context was John Hargrove bleeding, his face bleeding, and they're talking about like attacks, and that incident was not from whale aggression. I think he just fell basically and hit his head, and he talks about it in his book. Another one I do feel immensely for is Holly's footage taken out of context and making it look like it was about one of the trainers in the movie, one of the ex-trainers. There is that footage of like, you're gonna get on a killer whale and you're gonna ride it, and I don't think it was that trainer's intention. I think that trainer was just genuinely explaining what it was like. And there is that footage of Holly in the making, is it behind the scenes, I believe, or the making of, it's some like, I'll link it in the description, but this video that was like behind the scenes of Believe at Orlando, and it was her first time riding a killer whale. And they use that because it's like basically what the trainer in the film was describing. And I do feel bad for Holly that they took that moment, that like precious, amazing moment, and used it in this film to essentially bash the company and the animals, and I would say kind of bash maybe the animals that she worked with. However, I don't necessarily think it's like a damning feature of the film. I don't think it's as misconstruing as a lot of people really write it out to be. And I, even when I was pro, I never really thought that. Of course, like I can ID the animals and I'm just like, oh, they got all these wrong and la 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 la. And it was like frustrating for me. I think a lot of it is wrong that they did it and they took things out of context. And maybe they honestly just didn't know. Like with John Hargrove's thing, like maybe they were just like, oh, blood on a trainer at SeaWorld, bad, put in film. But there, I just think a lot of it is, I wouldn't necessarily put all of it as misleading. Obviously some of it is, like the ones I described before, and like the one with where they talk about Kasaka and Takara's separation, that one is misleading. They don't give all the details, which frustrates me too. I mean, now we can't really control it. I think maybe going back now, if I had the chance, if they went back now, they'd correct that. So yeah, I understand the issue with misleading and doctored footage. And in some of the areas, yes, I agree, it was wrong. In other areas, that's B-roll, honey. That is just part of film and part of documentaries and just having B-roll going on in the background. And when you're not going and like collecting the footage yourself to like show what you want, it's kind of harder to... like if there wasn't footage of Tilikum getting moved, that they were just like, oh, here's like it's showing moving. It may not be him, but it's a whale. You know, I don't think that showing Keiko, that it was like damning on the film. That one, I'm just like, yeah, okay. Like, yeah, it's not Tilikum, but it's how you move a whale. And I think they're more so just showing like what they're talking about. Another thing is they use Mark Simmons in the film, and he was still a current employee. I believe now he still works there, and he's come out with videos saying, like, they took what I said, like, they took the littlest things and blew them up, and he had, like, 3 hours of interview that they just didn't even use. And John Hargrove has the same feeling, and he went on to write a book, and he even said that he felt weird because they didn't use a lot of it because it was too... like happy. And I think I don't remember if he says in the book that they maybe even said something, but I think that's a really interesting point to bring up too. Now, John Hargrove's not, again, the most credible person or a good person at all, but that he even notes that a lot of his interview was either cut or like quote unquote non-usable because he had good things to say, because he had happy feelings, because he had just left and he loved the animals and it was hard for him to, I think, just outright be like, oh yeah, it's awful, blah, blah, blah. Another thing, there are a lot of claims about the other trainers in the film, credible they may be. And some of the things that have been brought up against them have been debunked, like the one about the trainer that was quote unquote fired for kicking an otter. That was about Dean Gomersall. I don't know how to say names, but he was working at Sea Lion Otter Stadium, and now a lot of pros throw around that he was fired because he like kicked an otter. But the situation was apparently different, and it has been debunked. I'll again link down below with this Tim Zimmerman website where he explains kind of what actually happened, and that he didn't kick an otter. What happened was he had basically put a plastic slider on the exit gate that like keeps them from like going through the door, like your doggy door. And he said basically that it must have struck the otter on the nose because there was blood all over and the otter had a cut on his nose, but that it wasn't like he like went out and like deliberately abused. He immediately notified vet staff to come and help the otter. And then the next day he was called by management and was being fired for injuring an animal and waiting 15 minutes for telling anyone. That 15-minute area was that he did not notice that when he dropped it, he had injured the animal. Now, again, that's that happens. And that's one that I'm like, he wasn't outright like kicking an otter, as I have seen put around. I used to tell people that all the time too. He was not fired for kicking an otter. He was fired, yes, for an issue with an otter, but he did not outright purposely do this to the animal. It was just something that happened and he got fired. And he even says that as he was being escorted out of the park by another trainer, the trainer said, "You got screwed and I'm sorry about what happened to you." Because they kind of understand, like, this situation, like, why would you do that on purpose? Now, the other trainers, again, there's a lot of claims that, like, some of them have never worked with Tilikum. And, like, John Hargrove, my response to that is I do kind of think that the questions we're maybe asking, I've been interviewed before. And a lot of times when you're being interviewed for a film, they may ask you to kind of explain things from a certain perspective. And if all their questions are about Tilikum, and obviously trainers worked at the same park as him, had friends who had worked with him, they may have kind of asked them in a way that would get them to talk about it from their own personal narrative. So it kind of sounded like they worked with them. There is the one trainer that says the whole time, that like, I stayed for Tilikum. I'm going to tell you that I stayed for Tilikum. And I think he had about 4 to 5 years of experience working with killer whales. And so obviously, like, those, I think that the claims against them have merit. But besides that, like, all the issues still, like, I think stand and speak for themselves. The issue with Dawn, the issues of aggression that we see in captivity, whether or not the input of the trainers speaks for themselves. Now, from a documentary standpoint, it is not great practice to get words from people that are not the most credible. Point blank period example of the witnesses of Kelty Byrne. That is like the biggest one in my mind that I'm just like, why? Like, especially like that, and leaving out the fact that all the fins, that's obvious. If you can't tell, that's like one of my biggest issues with the movie. But the claims against the trainers, I go back and forth on because it's a lot of hearsay. It's a lot of just discrediting and like, I think of a lot of the issues with what John Hargrove has said about, because, you know, he's been caught in lies a couple times where he talks about how they would withhold food. No, they wouldn't. Yeah, like people say things and other people have said that at one point they did withhold food. And I believe that. That was how we used to train a lot of animals. And obviously things have changed. Yay, good. And discredit where discrediting is merit. But I don't think... One, that otter story is, you know, like I explained, was out of context. He was fired, yes, for the otter issue, but it wasn't for what I had heard, which was kicking an otter, because he did not kick an otter. And I would caution everyone who may be listening that are pro-caps and have seen the same posts that I have on Instagram, discrediting and calling all of the trainers liars. To look into it as well, I'm specifically speaking about the SeaWorld Truth Team Instagram page from posts in 2017. So they're old. and mostly the point is like that they make is a lot of, well, they didn't even work with Tilikum. So blah, 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 blah. Which again, yeah, that's fair. But I'd also be cautious. Always look into it yourself as well. Don't take everything from both sides. This is for both sides. Obviously, anti-caps, please don't look at things and just take it immediately as like doctrine. Like this movie. Don't watch this movie and take all of it as just point blank fact, because it's not. Like I've explained, a lot of things are out of context, misconstrued, not fully fleshed out as they should be, as they have been in other films. And that is a problem. This film does a great job starting people to I think get introduced into the idea, this world of the complexities of captivity. But when people are just watching this movie once and saying they're like, I hate SeaWorld, I know everything I need to know. No, you don't. Like, I'm so sorry. There are so many more nuances to this issue. And so the same I will say at pro cap people who look at these pages and just see the fired, demoted, liar, to also look into that and to all the different issues, because everyone in this has like a quote-unquote agenda, so it's kind of hard to take everyone's just point blank word for fact. Like the issue, the freaking beginning of the documentary with the arm getting eaten off. Obviously, that serves the documentary greatly because it makes like an ear catching moment of he ate her arm, and we'll get people to like watch. Like it's a gasp moment. But don't include it because it's not true. Or if you're going to include it, maybe follow up with her arm was not bitten off. Essentially, that's, you know, that's my point there. So overall, sorry if this has been all over the place and if listening to this has given anybody a headache, because I feel like when I talk, I go everywhere. But I'd like to think there was some structure to this episode. But anyway, all in all, I would give this film maybe between a 5 and a 7 out of 10. 7's a bit high, actually. So maybe I think I said 7 on Taylor's video. But I think now, as I'm sitting through with my notes, I maybe give it a 5. I think it's decent. I think it's a good start. I think it kickstarted a lot of discussion and conversation and advocacy, but it also kickstarted a lot of false information, false narratives. A lot of issues also came from this. And one of my biggest issues is that it doesn't go into the nuances, and I fully believe this issue is nuanced. Now, moving on to my personal views on captivity, what I think should happen going forward. I'm against captivity, but I do not believe SeaWorld would ever release their animals into a sea pen. And with that knowledge, I think the best step going forward with companies like SeaWorld is to find ways to work with them for a common ground between the anti-captivity movement and the pro-cap movement, to find a middle ground where we're willing to kind of work together to acknowledge, I think that pros acknowledge, yes, inherently this has issues. Let's cause some solutions. And then where antis have to admit, there's also some good. There's a lot for these animals I don't understand, and that this life that they live in captivity is their life, and it is so much more complex than just saying release them. And that if they're not going to release them, let's expand tanks. Let's actually do more education. Let's, you know, finding basically a middle ground between both, where we acknowledge the issues, the pros and the cons, the nuances, all the good SeaWorld does as well, like their rescue program, the money that they fund for killer whale research, all that kind of stuff, and finding something that makes everyone happy in the time that they have killer whales left, because they have stopped breeding in 2016. They have a breeding ban. This is the last generation of killer whales in captivity at SeaWorld Parks. So I think by then, finding like a middle solution area is the perfect way to go. And I think one of those ways is implementing a lot more conservation work within the parks, spreading more awareness directly about the southern residents, about what guests can do, like giving guests the power to act on helping them versus just telling them. I think that's a big one. A tank expansion project of some sort would be amazing to see. I think that would be a great way to reach a middle ground. Of course, there's always going to be people who say, nothing will ever be the ocean. Yeah, you're right. Awesome. Now moving on, we can make their life a little bit better with a bigger tank. And I think people need to get over a bit of their pride in the situation. To say, I totally understand where people always argue that a tank will never live up to the ocean. Yes, that is true. Thank you. I respect your opinion. I respect your point. I agree with your point. But at the same time, they can never be released. Even then, you could argue a sea pen is never the full ocean because they will still have some sort of barrier from that quote-unquote full capacity that they could be living. And so for that reason, I, again, for like the fifth time, think that a middle ground area would be great. Do I know that middle ground area? No, I do not. I'm working on it. I'm working on finding a solution that I would be happy with, and I think that a lot of anti-caps would be happy with. And maybe some anti-caps may never go back to the parks, whether or not they respect what the parks are doing and agree and like think that they're moving in the right direction. That's fine. I'm not trying to say that we need to get people going back to the parks. Like, that is not what I advocate for. I don't advocate for boycotting, but I also don't advocate for making people who don't like SeaWorld to go back to SeaWorld. Because some people, no matter what they think, will see that orca in a tank and just think that that's awful and sad and never be able to kind of get over that sadness, which I respect. But I think that there are ways that the parks can move forward better than they are now. If that makes any sense. In my head, it makes sense. So lastly, I will leave you with resources. Now, the video with Taylor is up now, and it will be linked in the description. I also am going to share with you some of my favorite books that talk about either orca captivity or just orcas in general. Puget Sound Whales for Sale by Sandra Pollard. I think this book is great. It talks about the origins of captivity here in the Salish Sea. It's definitely, I think, a must read. It obviously has more of that anti-cap narrative, but it does a really good job basing the facts of the beginning, which I think all of us can agree that these captors were bad and were horrific. And learning about the history of the captors, it is not like an outright anti-cap propaganda book, which is why I think it's a good resource, whether or not you are for or against captivity, to have, because we all can learn about the Penn Cove captors. Next is Spirits of the Coast, which has a lot of different people involved in it. It has a captivity portion in it that is really good. It has like some cool stories in it. And then I don't even know if I want to recommend John Hargrove's book, because I really like it, but I don't want you to give him money. So John Hargrove has a really good book. If you can find like an online version, if I can find something where you can read it and not have to buy it, I will link it, because I don't think people should give him money. I'm really sorry. But it is still a really good book to go into the relationships that trainers and killer whales have, to more of the issues and I think his standpoint of being a trainer who loves the animals and loved his job, now being against captivity, how hard that was for him to kind of like deal with in his head. I think that's a really cool standpoint that he presents, and that he has a really good job. It's a really good writing, but yeah, I don't like him as a person, so I don't want to encourage people to buy that book if he's a bad person. So maybe look at your local library to rent that book. What is that book's name, you guys might ask? That is a good question that I literally just realized I did not tell you, because my head is literally all over the place. I apologize. But it is called Beneath the Surface. I just remembered. You can probably look at sites like Thrift Books. I don't think he'd get any money for buying it if it is like a thrifted book. So look on like online book thrift store if you want to buy it. It's a really good book. Anyway, so yeah, I will link all that below. I'll link also some websites where you can learn more about things I explained. I will link where I got a lot of my numbers from, so you can also explore them and check with me how accurate they are. But yeah, overall, I hope that this kind of showed that I really have a nuanced approach to this, and that as an anti-cap, you can look at a film like this and critique it and understand that it is not a perfect movie, and that doesn't make you a bad anti-cap. That just makes you understanding of many of the vast issues that are captivity, and that is the captive industry. So thank you for listening. It has been a pleasure to talk to myself and have a lot of people listen to it. But stay tuned for our next episode, and thank you so much for being here.